So I'm very super daunted, as I say, to be honouring a historian of such eminence and distinction, who's not only been writing so long, at length, on such a wide range of topics within the general field of cultural history, but how can one possibly also contain within a short talk, and I must say I thought we had 20 minutes, but okay, I'll try and get it done, all that richness and variety and erudition and delight. And all the more a problem in that while the type of my talk, Roger Chartier sans frontières, invites us to think of Roger Chartier without boundaries, its form has to be obviously within the boundaries of this panel. And a quart into a pint pot would be a considerable underestimate for the task in hand. So therefore what I'll say won't be synoptic appreciation or attempt at a condensation of Roger's work. Rather, I thought I'd use this slot to open up a productive perspective that through a personal appreciation of certain aspects of his writings that have been particularly important and resonant for me, and maybe that would resonate with other people as well. I'm all the more drawn to this approach in that Roger has eloquently warned us off that biographical illusion that one can summarise or encapsulate someone's life and career in that form. And moreover, he's been such a powerful voice calling for historians to focus on reader reception that I'll hope that this reader's perspective is in its way a homage to his teaching and not just the most abject narcissism of my part. So it's wonderful to get this invitation, send this paper, but of course you probably have all had this experience as well. You think 6 months in advance you're asked to give a title to a talk that you haven't really thought about very much. And my first reaction initially was that I'll take something from one of his books or one of his articles that's really, really famous and try and work out some title and work around that. And many of you will have noticed that in 1998, French Historical Studies did this very fine round table on Roger's work on the edge of a cliff. And Bonnie Smith and Jonathan DeWald and Bill Sewell and Roger himself contributed. And when you look at it, if you go back to look at it, it's full of cliff metaphors throughout. So I thought, okay, should I go down that road to drive over the cliff with Roger Chartier, backing away from the edge of the cliff and driving off in another direction with Roger Chartier, or maybe at the bottom of the cliff, or my favourite actually, on a ledge halfway up the cliff with Roger Chartier, waiting for helicopter rescue. Obviously, I was just going wild on this and getting more and more surreal, but I realised obviously it's ridiculous. And then Lynn told us the title of her paper, which had an edge, and I thought, well, there's enough edges and cliffs in this panel. So after much thought and tergiversation, I hit upon this idea, this title, which I think actually really works for me anyway, and I think it possibly does for others as well. It's very Chartieriste for me, and it captures things which are really essential for me to Roger's work. It does echo, first of all, a title of his devising. His classes at the Collège de France in 2011-12 were entitled Texte sans frontières, and there's an article in the 2015 book of essays, La main de l'auteur, in Esprit de l'imprimeur, with the same title. So it sort of shows it's Chartieriste in that sense, but also perhaps where he's going at the moment. Secondly, I think it evokes an important aspect of Roger's career, which has been conducted in such a transnational manner. And obviously, for some years now, he's split his teaching between France and the United States, between Paris and Penn, and the international aspect of his work is clearly apparent. And at first, I thought I would sort of go down that road which Bob and Lynn referred to, and I'd do a sort of like paper with loads of pie charts and graphs and maps of his professional peregrinations. I thought in that way I'd evoke that scholarly, those scholarly volumes, Livre Société dans la France du XVIIIe siècle, published in 1965 and then 1970, which marked the point where the history of the book was at the moment when Roger entered the history of the book. And I would, so it'd be seminars everywhere, honorary fellowships there, academic distinctions, translations a bit everywhere, and so on and so on. But then I thought, well, I might undertake also a quantitative analysis of his footnote references, which would reveal, I felt sure, and there would be graphs to show it, the extent to which he draws his intellectual inspiration right across national boundaries. Just think of it, always the names that come cropping up are an international crew, aren't they? German sociologist Norbert Elias, German political scientist Jürgen Habermas, Italian philologist Armando Petrucci, New Zealand book historian of the book, Donald McKenzie, to say nothing of his old friend and North American sparring partner, Bob Darnton. But then I thought, what's the point, really? All that effort would only tell us what we already know, that this is a scholar whose work evokes fascination, admiration, and respect across the globe, that his work draws inspiration from international sources, and that his distinction-laden career has an itinerancy to match. We know that already. Without the benefit of maps and graphs, we can say with certainty that a distinguishing feature of this wonderful career and his work is that it doesn't respect national or linguistic boundaries. It is truly sans frontières. Of course, I realised that the danger of selecting the title, because it's always dangerous, was that people might think that I was somehow making a comparison with the organisation MIDSA. So I think I should make clear that in choosing my title, I was not meaning to imply that I believe Roger is an important contributor to world health. But when I think about it, on the other hand, when you've got one of those knotty problems with the work of, say, Michel Foucault, Michel Certeau, Norbert Elias, Louis Marin, I find that turning to see what Roger has to say about them definitely does clear my mind and helps restore my mental equilibrium. So yes, his writings do have the quality of bringing aid, comfort and solace to the intellectually troubled and the mentally afflicted. And so in choosing the title of my talk, I also wonder whether my audience, or at least those of a certain age, I'll leave that undefined again, might think that I was somehow meaning to reference mass culture in the form of the game show, Jeu Sans Frontières. I don't know whether North American audiences all know that, but Jeu Sans Frontières, in Britain it was called It's a Knockout, was an immensely popular TV series which attracted huge mass audiences right across Europe from the 1960s to the 1980s. And it pitted teams of ordinary people from villages or something, from all the European nations, in really stupid and exotic outdoor games which involved people dressing up in animal costumes, falling into swimming pools and having huge number of large rubber balls raining down on them. So if you know the Eurovision Song Contest at all, think of it as the Eurovision Song Contest with balls, in fact. Now you may think that a mass entertainment like Jeu Sans Frontières is beyond the radar of a Collégien de France, but I'm encouraged in my belief to think that it wasn't, in that a few years ago I was listening to Roger when he came to England a number of occasions, and he always started his talk by saying, by modestly apologising for his French accent, which he claimed resembled that of Antoine de Caunes, the famous, well, I may not be famous here, but no. He was a TV presenter, probably best known in Europe for introducing and presenting a programme called Eurotrash. It's new heights, in fact, for low and vulgar comedy. In fact, Eurotrash makes the Jeu Sans Frontières seem like Proust. So if Roger knew about Eurotrash, I knew he'd know about Jeu Sans Frontières. So forays into popular culture, even of that sort, may seem minor or anecdotal interest in Roger's life. But of course, an awareness of the ease of crossing social and cultural boundaries, as well as national and linguistic ones, those that I've evoked, that's actually one of the hallmarks of Roger's scholarship, as well as his life. And for me, at least, one of his finest essays, and this is a bit like his finest essays, everyone has an appreciation, I'm sure people in the audience will say that as well, is the celebrated, and for me, again, much-cited essay, Culture as Appropriation, which appeared in a collection edited by Steve Kaplan in 1984, I think it was. I think I've been warmed up to the article's approach by reading and loving Daniel Roche's Le Peuple de Paris, which revealed the most Labroussian idea of popular classes not obsessed and repressed by the volatile price of bread, as we'd all been taught, at least I'd always been taught, but have actually purchased quite a bit of stuff. And for me, this, combined with the impact of Neil McKendrick's work on English consumerism in the late 18th century, to open up suddenly this new world of consumerism. My own work on medical consumerism followed this track, but of course scores and scores, probably hundreds of studies of early modern shopping have come in the way. If we might call Daniel Roche's approach sociocultural, Roche's was more cultural-social. Roche was combating the Labroussian notion of the popular classes hovering around the breadline, while Roger's targets seem more to be Geneviève Bollème and Robert Montroux, who in their studies of the repertoire of the Bibliothèque Bleue had viewed popular culture through possession of these cheap works as immersed in a timeless and putatively sensationalist and alienated world that seemed quite autonomous from learned and elite culture. Thin cultural gruel, one might say, to go with their bread obsession. In the article, however, Roger gives this view a ruthless scalpeling, which is still at this distance rather enjoyable to read. The presuppositions of the Montour approach are ruthlessly demolished, and on the basis of studies on the emergent history of the book, a new model is proposed which viewed popular culture not as something as static and autonomous, but either reflected or reinforced pre-existing social structure or else passed into the popular mind and mediated. Rather, the emphasis was on the process of how cultural objects were appropriated by an array of social groups. Was it from this moment on, it was for me, that books could be viewed as opening up a dynamic and dialectical relationship with the reader. The history of the book would no longer be just the history of the book, it would be the history of reading. And this approach was empowering for the way we thought of readers, particularly from the popular classes. They didn't, in other words, just swallow whole cultural products handed down to them. They picked and chose the texts they liked and could afford, and picked and chose within those texts too. And sometimes popular reading could, and here of course we know the impact of the ideas of Michel de Certeau and Daniel Roche, involve active popular resistance to elite ideas. Reading, like shopping in other words, was not lodged under the vast weight of longue durée determinism. It could be seen as a form of relating to the marketplace of commodities and ideas. Roche then seemed to be mapping out in a very embryonic form a whole research agenda for crossing frontiers, for breaking boundaries, national, linguistic, social, cultural. And that agenda, I think, has been more than apparent ever since in his writing. It's shaped the history of the book, obviously, in manifestly, enormously powerful ways. Were I looking for another type, the other one I was playing with, actually, was which I think would reflect Roger's, I think, increasing interest in the spatial dimension of text, is texts in space. Because if we, in an article, for example, in the 2015 collection, we find Roger taking us on a sort of transnational journey following the print history of Las Casas' famous short history of the destruction of the Indies, a crucial text, as you'll know, in the construction of the black legend of colonization of the Americas. Written in 1542 to describe Las Casas' experiences in the Americas, first published in Seville in 1552, Roger then follows the translation and publication history, translations in Protestant countries in the late 16th century, Frankfurt, 1598, Venice, 1626, Barcelona, London publishes 1656, then Paris, and we follow these around, not, I think, just as a sort of longitudinal history, which is one way and an older way of doing it, but the article really is about differing social forms of readership is in the national niches, national and linguistic niches in which they occur. And we see that cultural, social, but also national linguistic cross-boundaries approach deployed with even greater subtlety, insight, and imaginative reach in his most recent book, Caldeño entre Cervantes et Shakespeare, published in France in 2011 and English in 2013. Roger modestly describes his project, which I'm going to spend just a few minutes on, as, quote, interweaving the meanderings of Don Quixote with a mystery of a play lacking a text but not lacking an author. The book far surpasses this bald account. I think it's a fantastic book, in fact, and I want to say something about it. Whereas the text Sans Frontières essay I mentioned earlier focused on a piece of writing of international renown and very wide circulation across Europe and the Atlantic world, in the Cardenio book, the text in question doesn't even exist. The range of the set of issues encompassed the broader, and in addition, as I say, the text in question is a lost play, a textual void, in fact. And from that textual void, Roger takes us through a quite extraordinary story, a saga even, which I'll briefly outline. A register in the King's Crown's Royal Chamberlain's Office in 1613 mentions payment of a sum of money to the group of players known as the King's Men for a performance of a play called Cardena. We know that the principal personage in one of Cervantes' Don Quixote was Cardenio. That had been published in English translation just the year before. It had appeared in Spanish in 1605 and was the first early modern transnational intercontinental bestseller. We may think of it as one of the great early modern novels of the European tradition, but Roger shows how contemporaries saw it more as a treasure house of stories, a serviceable repository of plots and storylines that could be ripped off, used in other contexts. The Cardenio name and story appear in a Spanish play in 1605-6, and we wait for in 1628 for its first French adaptation. By then, the characters of the novel were already appearing in processions of popular festivals, court ballets and masquerades, and engravings and in poems right across the Spanish Empire, but then across this side of the Atlantic, all over Europe as well. Then Roger's story takes an unusual and unexpected turn. Although no manuscript or text of the 1613 play has ever surfaced, some 40 years later, in fact, in 1653, the English bookseller and publisher Humphrey Moseley claimed the privilege of publishing this work, that he stated that the play had been composed by John Fletcher, a playwright who indeed had drawn on Cervantes in his other plays, plus his contemporary, one William Shakespeare, of whom I'm quietly confident many of you will have heard. Such collaborations, including between Shakespeare and Fletcher, were quite common. Maybe this Cardenio was published? We don't know. We don't have an example. Plot thickens in the early 18th century. 1727, one of the publishers of Shakespeare's collected works in England, Lewis Theobald, presented what he claimed was the missing work, which he renamed Double Falsehood or The Distressed Lovers. And he had assembled it, he said, from three Shakespearean fragments, so he proved unwilling to show them to anyone. We don't know if they actually exist. There were some performances of the play. From this story about the absence of a text, only posthumously attributed to Shakespeare, Roger is unable to unfold a penetrating analysis of the nature of authorship and reception in the early modern period. From the traces of a sort of ghost, if you like, he pieces together a sort of textual regime, a set of practices existing and governing the authorship and readership of texts in the early modern period, which contrasts sharply and starkly with the type of regime, the textual regime, put in place in Western culture from the mid to late 18th century onwards. Works of literature, well, the very concept of literature needs to be used with utmost caution in this period. Respect for genre, well, these putative great works of literature were quite cheerfully drawn on across any generic divide. The novel was turned into mini-novels, plays, ballets, poems, and so on. Respect for the integrity and sacrality of the original text, well, there is, and as far as we know, was no original text at all to spawn the history that Roger recounts. Practices of translation, important part of the story, were nothing like our own, to put it mildly. Originality, well, the plays in review were based on reuse, recyclings, borrowings, and adaptations of every kind. Ripping off of plagiarism were par for the course. The author function, not a sole author, but a congeries of individuals and troops of players and collaborators. Myths of creativity, precisely that, myths. Jobbing adaptability and responsiveness to clients, patrons, publishers, acting troops, etc., seem the rule. The book itself, well, the case study shows that the history of the book, as often practiced, needs to be rethought so as to incorporate a fuller and more complex range of forms, including manuscript, obviously, but also performances and other practices of orality. The audience, well, in the context of generic variety, producer collaboration, and spatial production and consumption, it's clear there is no simple reader, but rather a socially constituted, constructed set of readers and viewers with very different cultural horizons, expectations, and reactions. In this general picture of instability and mobility, only one stable element really stays there over the course of the 17th and 18th century, and that is the prestige of the name Shakespeare as putative author of this missing text, this lost play. So it seems to me there's a really important message here about the historicity of textual regimes and the dangers of anachronism when we're doing early modern history. All the holy cows of the textual regime set in place in the last since the late 18th century, the very notion of literature, creativity, originality, genius, textual integrity, stability, and so on, all those holy cows are here ritually slaughtered. And indeed, in a nod towards Bob Danton, we might even think of Cardenio, the book by Roger, as the great holy cow massacre. But Boucher offers us a twist in this wonderful tale. In an absolutely riveting final section, he leaps into the late 20th century to bring us up to date. And very weird to recount, this non-text, this sort of simulacrum of a text, has been performed far more times in the last quarter of a century than in the four centuries before. Because what Roger labels Cardenio fever starts up, and it starts up in the early 1990s when a scholar called Charles Hamilton, on the basis of handwriting analysis, argues that a play from 1611 or 1613 by Thomas Middleton, the Jacobean playwright, called Second Maiden's Tragedy, was in fact the missing text of the Lost Cardenio. This offered a cue to aspiring playwrights and producers to stage what they thought or what could be passed off as a new play by Shakespeare, and indeed staged it has been. And indeed, in the last chapters, Roger lists nearly a dozen different versions of a text that, under the guise of standing in for this lost play, have been performed transnationally across the Anglophone world in recent decades. Some do it by relying on Middleton, some rely on the 1727 text. There's a tendency to bring in gobbets, if you like, of both Cervantes and Shakespeare, and to pass everything off as this play. Probably the most egregious example is that of a dynamic afterlife of a lost play. It's a completely new play, the title Cardenio, that Stephen Greenblatt devised with dramatist Charles Mee in 2008. And this particular confection has been internationally performed in Spanish, Croatian, Japanese, and Bengali translation, trading as Cardenio, quote, inspired by a lost play by William Shakespeare. In the age of globalization, Cardenio has clearly gone global. So this whole fabulously interesting and ridiculous farrago increasingly takes on the dimensions of a cock and bull story of Sternian proportions, and referencing the writer of All the Enlightenment, least respectful of boundaries and frontiers, Lawrence Stern, is not inapposite for this sans frontière appreciation. But what I found also very stimulating and thought-provoking that I'll leave you with were points to which Roger alludes in the book, but perhaps doesn't develop them as fully as he might, and will do, I'm sure, go on to do. When we examine the practices of the text in our own 21st century, we find the practices of modernity under strong challenge in a world characterized by post-modernity and digital technologies. The unpredicted recent afterlife enjoyed by Cardenio serves to some extent, I think, as an exemplar. Collaboration is much more part of production practices, as is a historical back and forth over authentic and non-authentic text, producing sometimes what seems a very un-Shakespearean hybrid. Then again, in our digital world, texts are almost intrinsically unstable, as Roger has himself pointed out. It's as if a cyclical movement is in play, so that we seem in some ways to be going back, jumping over the top of the authorial regime of modernity installed in the late 18th century, back to an early modern textual regime into which we have numerous points of resemblance and similarity. It's interesting too, the only stable element in all the chopping and changing evidence throughout this whole world of Cardenio fever is the name of William Shakespeare himself. But this operates less as a plausible author than as an international brand, conferring commercial value and cultural capital on a variety of outputs characterized by all sorts of forms of collaborative bricolage. Yet in a final paradox, Roger notes that it is an obsession with national literary heritage that produces an itch for completeness, finding that missing Shakespearean text, and authenticity, capturing the true Shakespeare, that generates and multiplies these putatively Shakespearean Cardenio texts. And the paradox is there to set us thinking, to set us thinking hard about character and the historicity of texts and the porosity of boundaries. How very quintessentially Roger Chartier.